Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt or disrupt our daily lives. This edition of 411 Teen features the Eye to Eye organization and founder David Flink. One in five children in the United States has a learning disability. Since 1998, Eye to Eye has grown into a nationwide nonprofit that pairs middle school children who have a learning disability with high school and college students who also have a disability. Recently, David Flink was selected to CNN Heroes Top 10. He has a chance to be named Hero of the Year at the 15th annual CNN Heroes All-Star Tribute. It's hosted by Anderson Cooper, and it will be on Sunday, December 12th. If you're interested, you'll want to vote for him. And once you hear this program, because he is truly dynamic, I'm sure you will be running to vote. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. And David Flink, a special welcome to you. 411 Team is glad to have you.
Liz, what an honor. Thank you for that kind introduction. It is great to be here.
Yeah, I am looking so forward to talking with you. Share with us, oh goodness, you encountered hard times in school, yes?
Yes.
And I guess that was the impetus for you to, at some point, develop, establish Eye to Eye. So you seems like you kind of knew, you know, that the issues were there. You knew what was happening, particularly for LD kids. So share with us how it evolved.
Sure. Well, you know, I have to start by saying I just love that your program starts with the idea that we're talking to young people and, of course, the families around them, because I think so much of my experience and work has been channeling now the wisdom of young people into our work. And at the beginning, I was, as sometimes I think about it, I was a former young person. So I can happily start with sort of the beginning of that story. As somebody with dyslexia and ADD, and I learned of those identities in about the fifth grade, school was by no means easy. I very much remember more time spent outside the classroom than in it. By no real fault of the educators around me, but I was born in 1980, and y'all remember, mm-hmm. for those who were around in those years or before, we didn't really know what to do with kids who didn't fit in the norm. Mm-hmm. And when you have dyslexia and ADHD and you struggle with reading or paying attention, you don't know what to do with the kid. Oftentimes you quote unquote individualize the education by having them sit outside the hallway and do it by themselves. So yeah. It was nothing shy of a miracle that I got through school, ultimately got to college, and I realized that part of what could have made my life significantly better is if I had some near peer role models, some examples of people who had just made it. I didn't mm-hmm. have any of those examples, and I should name, you know, I had a lot of privilege. I'm a white man in America I had some means. My mom actually was an educator in the school, so I was very lucky to make it through school. Most people who learn the way that I learn still to this day don't. So Eye to Eye's inception was taking the idea that people who've had this lived experience and figure out how to make it work can help everyone. And that was really how Eye to Eye began. That's figuring out, as college age students who had learning differences, maybe we could go mentor some middle school kids who had the same experience and make a difference.
Well, I want to go back some, because it was so interesting to read about Eye to Eye. And it seems like you knew that you weren't learning like other kids, okay, way back then. How did you know this? What were the signs? And I say this for the listening audience. And I think that, you know, would be real helpful. Kids, you know, who may be going through some changes, they know that they're having issues or whatever you want to identify. But how did you How did you handle this? How did you know this was going on?
If I understand your question, you're really asking, how did I know that I was learning differently and that I wasn't somehow disabled? And I think, you know, it's worth naming. The language is very complicated. So I didn't, like, at the beginning say, hey, guys, let's just be clear. I'm a little different, but I'm not broken. In fact, you know, it's just, it's so challenging even to this day when you, when you're a teenager, maybe a little younger, and you're said, hey, we understand you're trying your best and you seem to not be getting good grades. And then they give you these words, dyslexic, ADHD, dysgraphia, learning disability. In none of those words do you feel like, oh, okay, I'm going to be great here. So it certainly wasn't easy or early. And I think I spent probably the majority of my childhood actually fighting that language. It took me a long time to recognize that, of course, I'm not going to discount. I'm super dyslexic today, the same as I was when I was first identified. If you ask me to do a reading test today, none of us are going to have fun. I'm still very slow, and I definitely have dyslexia. But, you know, to get to what I love in your question, the beautiful part of that question was to realize that I was differently abled and not disabled. It took, frankly, at the time, adults around me showing me that my brain was beautiful. And I could learn that in a lot of other ways that wasn't just reading with your eyes. For starters, when I was given permission to quote unquote read with my ears, again, for listeners who are not currently teenagers, Liz, you may remember the tape, the precursor to the iPod, right? When I was told that I could read with my ears and that that was an acceptable way to show my brain was beautiful. And suddenly I did better in school. That little shift made all the difference. And these were adults who were making it permissible for me to say, hey, I learned differently, I'm not broken. So I never, and even to this day, would discount the real experience of being somebody who has fundamental differences. And some of those differences come with weaknesses, but it's also because people showed me my strengths that I was ultimately able to flourish. And that's a lot of the work that I do now.
Well, talk more then about Eye to Eye. What was the impetus for you to found the organization? How did you decide on Eye to Eye? Elaborate on that, please.
So I think, like all good ideas, it was very much by accident. Okay. You know, I think sometimes in the retelling of stories, we love to say I was, you know, struck by lightning or whatever. And what really happened is, well, for starters, I didn't have permission. Well, I maybe had permission to learn differently. I did not have permission to talk about my difference, except for when absolutely necessary. And it was interesting because I remember getting to college and actually asked my roommate to proofread a paper for me. I got through, you know, school up to that point, always having some ally help me with that part of my learning. And I knew that I wasn't particularly good at spelling. And only later to discover, after I got the paper back with tons of spelling errors and kind of went after my roommate asking him why he didn't help me like he said he would. And he said, well, he was dyslexic. And I said, well, I'm dyslexic. And that for me was not the beginning of Eye to Eye, but it was like, oh my gosh, we have to do something to normalize and make acceptable talking about these things. And so Eye to Eye's brilliance, if I can even say that, came from a collection of people figuring out, all who had learning differences, and using our approximate knowledge, saying, okay, what would it look like if instead of being ashamed of our identities, we talked about them with pride? Instead of being ashamed that we do things differently, we talked about them as strategies for learning success. And instead of thinking about playing the game of school, we talked about playing the game of learning. What would life look like if we ascribe to that philosophy, and how could we make a difference? And so the beginning of Eye to Eye was really just kind of a ragtag bunch of various students from around my college campus, all going to a local school and saying, like, without much of a plan, it was a very ADHD plan. We like showed up there and we were like, show me your kids with learning differences. And they're like, here they are. And we're like, great, now what are we gonna do? And it was really co-created between us as mentors, all of whom were very willing and prideful of our learning differences. And these kids who had never once witnessed that model of success, living and breathing, walking into their school. And so we taught them what we knew. And I think ultimately we helped change the culture of that school because their near peers who maybe didn't have learning differences suddenly started seeing them differently. And even the teachers around them said, oh, okay, these kids are bound for greatness. I got it.
Oh, that's great that you had that kind of support, because so often you hear the negative. I mean, it's been said, you know, these kids, they're just lazy. They need to focus on what they're doing. They need to work harder on what they're doing. And so that's why they aren't accomplishing things.
Yeah, I think like any misunderstanding and, you know, well-intentioned along the way. I think in thinking about teachers, I'm sure there's some teachers listening today. You know, my mom taught for 40 years and she is my hero. And teachers in general are my hero. I don't think there is one teacher in the world who doesn't show up thinking, how can I help these kids find success? Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of times the, you know, criticism that is thrown at teachers is unjust, as though somehow they're not doing enough. I don't believe that any teacher believes in their heart that a kid is lazy or not trying hard enough. I think they're just not given the right tools sometimes to help these kids. And luckily, the tools now are very well known. And if we just figure out ways to ask the kids how they might succeed, they'll usually tell us. Mm-hmm. And then we just have to have the confidence to give them that and know that in no way are we cheating them. In fact, we're probably giving them tools that are going to serve them the rest of their lives.
And I might add, and we'll talk about this, that one of the tools that's not always have to be medication. And I wanted to commend you on that, because I didn't see that perspective coming through in reading about Eye to Eye. Yeah, there may be some that may need some medication. But I think there has been an approach in the schools that any kid that learns differently needs some medication. And you and I know that that indeed is not the case. So I applaud you. I hope I didn't misread that, but I applaud you, because that didn't seem to be the case where you were concerned.
You know, I think, again, just to note my own privilege in now helping to share what I learned and how I got to where I got.
Let me stop you in mid-sentence and ask you to hold that thought, because we're going to take a brief break and then come back. I'll continue. You're tuned in.
Okay, cliffhanger.
Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this edition features David Flink, founder of Eye to Eye, a nonprofit organization that middle school students who learn differently with high school students who learn differently. They merge together. We're going to take a brief break and we'll continue our conversation on Eye to Eye. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with David Flink, founder of Eye to Eye, a nonprofit organization that matches middle school students who learn differently with high school students who also learn differently. David, I had to stop you in mid-sentence, so would you like to continue your thoughts, please?
Thank you, Liz. Yeah, you left a great cliffhanger, right?
Right, I did. It worked
you
out
did.
Perfectly.
What do we
it?
Do about medication? tune in more. You know, the thing that I really feel lucky about in my journey was that medication was laid out on the table alongside a number of other tools. And the privilege I was given was to understand that as the context changed, I needed to pick up different and varied tools. And so literally at the same time I was offered Ritalin, I was also offered a BOSU ball to sit on instead of a chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I know that might sound silly.
No, it doesn't. It sounds great. If you're
great.
ADHD, that's perfect.
To move around.
Yes.
And I'll be honest with you, at that time I did both.
Mm-hmm.
And both had a different effect on me and provided some ability to focus. I mean, I say I chose. Let's be honest. I was, you know, in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. My family helped make that choice. But over time, the, you know, medication came in and out. The BOSU ball came in and out. Slowly, the BOSU ball moved its way more to the gym than in my classroom. That was fine because my days were a lot shorter. If you think about a college day relative to a full high school day. And in addition, I mean, I'm just talking about those two tools put in front of me. I was also given a whole plethora of additional tools and resources. And just, I mean, frankly, the most powerful tool that was given to me was the metacognitive ability to know how my brain works and how I think best. And then I would couple that with the ability to advocate for what I needed. So over time, I realized, hey, you know what? I could take Adderall all day. And that might be good if I have to sit and focus for an entire day. But in the long run, that's not going to be what my life looks like. Most jobs don't look like that. So as education evolved, I was able to evolve the tools around me to really supply me what I needed to just succeed. And that's true to this day, by the way. There's not some secret formula that I use to get by as somebody who learns differently. It literally is an evolving equation as I get older and the world changes around me.
Well, you made a comment earlier, and I just wanted to applaud you, and I was so glad to hear you say it, because about half of the parents believe that children will grow out of their learning differences, okay? That, you know, whatever happens, if they don't receive the support, or if they require or lack any type of early intervention, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They don't receive, they're going to grow out of it. And you said earlier, hey, I did not grow out of this. I'm still dyslexic. And I think that that is important for the listening audience to hear. So I just wanted to comment on that. How can school administrators and teachers and leaders encourage this type of mentorship among their students? Because I think this would be just dynamic. I mean, you've got students mentoring students, and they all are coming from the same place.
Yeah, it is magic. And, you know, when I go around the country getting to visit schools, seeing these relationships blossom, I am constantly struck by the connection that these kids find with each other. And they're changing, you know, back and forth tools to help each other do better in school. And I really mean both ways, by the way. Sometimes a mentee does become a mentor, which is kind of awesome to see. But to answer your question around how school leaders and administrators and teachers can really help foster and culture this, I mean, the first step, and of course, they can always reach out to Eye to Eye. Many of our tools and resources are free and available for them to put into practice in their schools immediately. But I'd actually just start by a mindset. If your approach to the 20% in all likelihood of your school that learns differently is that these are students who are going to be needing additional resources, who are going to be, you know, somehow problematic. And I'm not saying that that might be the intentional sort of philosophy, but somewhere in the back of your mind, if that is how you're stepping into this equation, you're going to already find yourself kind of on your back foot. Mm-hmm. In all likelihood, you do not need to do something more. You need to do something different. And so just to harken back to the example I gave from when I was a kid, which is still as good example as any, if you believe that every kid needs to read quickly with their eyes, and that's what a good and smart kid does, and one of those kids in your classroom has dyslexia, that kid measured against that standard is never going to be as successful as somebody without dyslexia. However, if you believe that young people need to be able to digest knowledge, gather it, understand it, process it, make sense of it, and then, you know, somehow produce their own thoughts relative to it back in the world, and you say, and you can process that knowledge with your eyes, with your ears, if you want to listen to it instead of, you know, read it with your eyes, if you want to learn it by, you know, going and watch a film on the topic, if you give kids the opportunity to ask themselves the question of how do I want to learn this, and then make it permissible for, frankly, all students, that permission will not cause your entire school to implode. If anything, it'll do quite the opposite. So that's like a philosophy that I think any school leader or teacher can do. And again, some of this is learned from my journey and also learning from talking to fabulous teachers across the country who implement these methods and see results. And it's not just academic results. It's these kids' soul catches on fire. And we've all seen it. When a kid is excited about being able to access knowledge, they're excited about life and learning.
Well, it seems like the unique component of your mentorship program enhances one's self-esteem. I mean, yes. Because you talk about the brains are beautiful, helping kids to realize their brains are beautiful. That's real positive. That's really empowering. So would you elaborate and talk about just, there's so many things I want to say to you about, but let's talk about this, the self-esteem, and then I want to go back to, because you were talking about the what you were saying earlier also has to do with education at the college level, what these teachers are being taught. But let me, I know I'm jumping all over. Let's go back to the self-esteem.
Yeah.
How does your unique program enhance the self-esteem?
Liz, I'm sure you've seen this with many of the guests you brought on, particularly over the past pandemic. You know, self-esteem is key to everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's particularly key to students who learn differently. And the way I often think about it is if you do not think about self-esteem like a piggy bank, you need to be able to make deposits in the kid's self-esteem piggy bank every day. And you do that by seeing them for their full selves and celebrating them no matter what, right? Especially their accomplishments that they're proud of. And once you, if you got a full self-esteem piggy bank, right? Well, you're going to need to make a withdrawal sometimes. When do you have to make a withdrawal? When a challenge happens.
Right.
When suddenly something, particularly if it's something that it seems like some of your peers are getting and you're not getting, you may have to make a withdrawal. And so if you have a very full self-esteem piggy bank, you can afford to take that risk to say to your teacher, hey, you know, I have ADHD and this assignment, totally excited about it, ready for the test. But if I take this test in this classroom with all these other students clicking their pens and chewing their gum and tapping their feet, I'm not going to be able to focus. So can I just take it in a different room? That takes a withdrawal.
Uh-huh.
But then they get what they need. And they can succeed. And so I can't stress this enough. Self-esteem is the foundation by which every other learner is able to thrive.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I strongly agree with that. That's why I noticed it. Talked about the self-esteem. You know, we get so excited, or I do, and the information is so stimulating. Share with my listening audience your contact information, a website or email, if they want to know more about Eye to Eye.
Yeah, thanks for that. Anybody who's listening, you can find us on eyetoeyenational.org. That's eyetoeyenational.org. And what you'll find if you visit our website is we'll take you on a couple of different tracks depending on what you're looking for. So if you're an educator, we have a whole professional learning track. So we can help educate you and your team about tools and strategies and experiences of people who learn differently so you can be better on the equation of being able to say yes to kids. And if you're a young person, we can take you on a journey where you can find a mentoring program in your school, or we can help you start one, or you can start an eye-to-eye club. We have this new club called the LD Alliance that we just launched, which is super exciting. So we can help you, you know, in those ways. Our real vision is a world where young people can ask for what they need and the adults around them know how to and feel excited to say, yes, we can provide that. Mm-hmm. So I hope listeners reach out and find us online. And also, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, the CNN Heroes moment is very exciting for us. You can find us online if you just Google David Flink or Eye to Eye CNN Heroes. We are one of 10 other organizations that are being spotlighted during this time as an organization that deserves to be seen and heard, especially after this pandemic. So voting for our cause is a way to say to the nation, hey, 20% of people who learn differently, let's listen. Let's listen to what they have to say and let's make sure that we give them what they need.
How would you identify, what would the ideal classroom, what would the ideal classroom look like for students who learn differently?
You know, I think that there are probably some like physical changes that any of us might imagine that could just make it feel a little more safe or equitable. So like giving people the option of a BOSU ball versus a chair, or, you know, thinking about, you know, the type of technology that might be more readily, not even accessible, because most of the technology, frankly, is in classrooms now, but allowable to be used. But I would actually argue that the thing you would see in an ideal classroom has less to do with the physicality of the school, of the classroom, and more to do with the spirit. You know, I would hope to see some version of a class constitution that the teacher and all the students sign that says, you know, regardless of your learning style, your brain is beautiful. You know, I'd love to see a space in which when assignments are given out, that, you know, teachers offer the invitation for students to do those assignments in a variety of ways to show their mastery of knowledge. You know, I think that the same way that we've really had to come to a bit of a reckoning around what equity means in our schools, we have to understand that students who learn differently do need more than some of their, you know, learning non-LD peers. But it's only so that they have an even playing field to give it their best shot, because so much of how we've designed school culture is around the 80%. And it's just, you know, it's a chance for us to build a school culture that's really celebrating everybody to have what we like to think of as a least restrictive learning environment.
David, I understand that you were diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia at a relatively, I guess, early age. What were you in, about fourth grade, fifth grade?
Yeah, fifth grade.
Okay. Share for our listening audience, particularly, what was your experience in school? And say, when I say, what was your experience in school, did you feel you were treated differently by teachers and fellow students?
Yeah. I mean, I was a pariah. I was the kid that nobody wanted to be around as soon as I got that label. I didn't know or understand that there were other kids who learned like I did. I mean, let's take a step back. Up until the diagnosis, I mean, I like the word identity, but it was like at the time an official diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I was just a kid who didn't know why I was struggling with learning, because all the ways that were being offered to me did not fit with how my brain worked. So I went up until that moment thinking, well, I guess I'm stupid because a smart kid sits and reads well and I can do neither of those things. So I got those labels, and it only confirmed for me what I thought was, well, I guess I don't belong here. I will say, and especially now, because of the awareness that even right now we are doing on this show, that is not the experience I think many kids have.
Right.
Getting those labels means, holy moly, I'm a part of this amazing community. Mm-hmm. I'm a part of, frankly, a very large community, and also a community that's gone on to do great things. I mean, having role models is helpful, and having accessible role models is helpful. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I got the labels. They actually kicked me out of the school not long thereafter. I went to five different schools. So I've seen a lot of different schools in my time. But I was told, don't worry, you know, Tom Cruise and Whoopi Goldberg both have dyslexia. You're going to be fine. Mm. And I thought, okay, well, I don't want to be an actor or a comedian. And neither of them were coming to mentor me right now. And then Scientology cured Tom Cruise. So then I only had Whoopi. And she wasn't hanging with me. And I really just was striving to find people who were more like me. And, you know, kind of real people that were just accessible and that, you know, and that I, and so I don't think that that's the story now. I think we have a lot more versions of what dyslexia and ADHD looks like. And it's not just celebrities now. It makes it so when a kid gets that label, they feel seen and they feel a part of a community. And that's my mission, to make sure that no matter where you are in the world, no matter what your background is, that when you get that LD label, you know you got family.
What role do you feel the universities and teacher education plays? Because if teachers don't come, and I'm not trying to throw teachers under the bus or anything, but if teachers don't have the right attitude, if their attitude is still that these kids are different, these kids are really disabled, because that's still the term that's used, as opposed to saying that these kids are different. They're thinking these kids are disabled. I would think that has an impact on how they approach the child, how they approach what they're doing, you know, that they are disabled. And they really, well, they aren't really disabled. I mean, they just learn differently. That may make them appear like they're disabled. And they're not disabled. They're marching to a different drummer.
Yeah, they're differently abled. You know, I even thinking about my own training, I am a trained educator. and going all the way through my undergraduate and master's degree and all that stuff, I was always struck by the fact that in all my training, I was always talked about, quote unquote, these kids. And I am trained as a special educator, so I went all the way. And I never met those kids. In fact, quite often I remember I'd kind of raise my hand in class and say, hey, we've just spent, you know, half a semester talking about kids who have, like me, kids who have dyslexia or something. Can I just share with the class that they turn out okay? Because everything we've talked about is like, you should be concerned.
Right.
And I think, you know, empathy training can be really helpful. I mean, one of the things that Eye to Eye is engaged in as we developed a professional learning is working with universities so that as a part of their training of educators, they meet, you know, still fairly young, but successful young adults who have these learning differences so they can share, in fact, not just theoretically what kind of accommodations helped them and how those accommodations made a difference between not an A and a B, but an A and an F, but also like how those differences led to them leading successful lives. And I think it's like anything, you know, if you know one dyslexic, you know one dyslexic. Mm-hmm. You really need to meet a lot of people, because the thing I love about learning differences is you can't look at someone knowing that they learn differently. And learning differences touch everyone. And so it doesn't matter your race or your religion, your ethnicity, you know, and when you have dyslexia plus that intersectional identity, it all has different varieties to it. And so we really have to better understand the populations that we're serving and stop medicalizing them so much and really thinking about them as a social construction.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break. You tuned in to 411 Teen, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. This hour, I'm talking with David Flink about learning differences. David was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia, but it hasn't stopped him. David, we're almost at the end.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Eye to Eye's curriculum utilizes art as a self-expression tool. How does this enhance the learning process?
So art was something that we discovered in the journey to build a curriculum because it was something that did two things. One, it was incredibly safe. We understood that kids might be coming to our program having had a little bit of traumatic experience trying new things. You know, school had not necessarily worked out for them before they found their way into our world. And so art was a thing where you could say, build something. And no matter what, it was going to look beautiful. Mm-hmm. So that was one place why art mattered and why if you're at home and you're thinking about something to do with your kid based on this conversation, pull out some art supplies to have the conversation. You'd be surprised at how far you'll go with it. And the second reason why that's the case is we learned that art very much can serve as a vehicle for young people to find their voice. And that is the essence of any success that a kid with a learning difference has. They have to find their voice. They have to be able to say what they need, know what they need, and ask for what they need. And so that's how we discovered art. And it's not like we discovered art, right? Art's mm-hmm. in our society. And if we all think about how art impacts us, you know, we can take that art and put it on display. And now suddenly the school is looking, people in the school are looking at this thing, better understanding how somebody in their community learns and thinks.
Okay. I have one other question I had wanted to ask you about teachers. And I know we talked about it, but I wanted to go back to it because I'm just wondering if they don't get the training that they need to be able to even identify a learning difference. Because what happens is, you know, the teacher says the kid is, you know, is bad, he's disruptive, he's not paying attention, he's all these things. And instead of identifying him as all these things, that right there ought to say, oh, maybe something else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Does that reasoning make sense?
Yeah, and I think that actually you have suggested, and I think you're right, as far as actually we should ask our teachers to go. Mm-hmm. I think we have to more so enforce within our schools permission for teachers to say, something doesn't sound right here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to recommend, because teachers are not qualified, and nor should they be. They have enough
right.
on their plates
they
to both teach the kids and identify them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the school system is in place so that a teacher can recommend to the school psychologist, you know, hey, can you check out something going on here? Because something's not right. And if you catch it at a young enough age, you can really then mm-hmm. put this kid on a path to success, and it doesn't exactly. snowball into a big challenge.
Exactly. Exactly. Any suggestions about how we eliminate or mitigate the whole stigma that is associated with learning differences?
I think like anything, we just have to find safe ways to share our stories. If you're someone listening today and has a learning difference, in a safe way, tell somebody who you know, trusts you and loves you, that part of your story. You'd be surprised what a difference that would make.
Mm-hmm.
If you know you feel more confident, you know, go slightly bigger with it, you know, with that story. You can ask others. You know, I should mention, we didn't talk much about it today, but in 2014, I authored a book called Thinking Differently. And in the book, I shared a bunch of other people's stories, thinking that would help break down the stigma. It's very much a book for parents. Mm-hmm. I wanted parents to see all these different versions of the story. And after writing the book, HarperCollins, my publisher, came back and said, you know, this book's great, but like, you didn't include your story in it. I said, mm-hmm. I don't want this book to be about me. This is really about other people. And they said, well, you have to show the way. If you can't expect other people to tell their story if you don't do it too, which is why I'm here with you today.
Mm-hmm.
So even I struggled with figuring out how to tell my own story. So you got to practice. Mm-hmm. And maybe someday, you know, you can invite all those people to come on your show, Liz. Like that's the dream, that they would feel confident enough to share their story in a forum like this.
Well, your program matches high school and college students with middle school students. Why middle school students?
So let me ask you a question, Liz. how was middle school for you?
Oh, it was all right. It really was.
It was all right.
It was all right.
You know? It was all right, right?
Yeah.
I think most people won't. That's the bar. You have gone to the highest level that anyone says about middle school. It was all right.
It was all right. Yeah.
And it only goes down from there. I think most people would say it was all right. I mean, middle school is tough for all kids. Your body is changing. You're naturally starting to want to separate from your home life and make your own identity. School just got a lot harder. You've gone from like learning to read to reading for learning. And so we focus on middle school because it is ripe for that space where both kids are going to find more challenge,
mm-hmm.
but also kids are going to be more apt to take on more independence, to figure out how to ask for what they need, to be susceptible to somebody other than their parents or teachers teaching them something. So middle school is a precious spot. We can fail kids miserably, or we can really empower them.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody gets through middle school completely unscathed, but we're going to do our best to make sure that it's an empowering place for them.
You have an 18-week program. And I know mm-hmm. I'm jumping around, but I know we don't have much time, so I want to try to touch on some different things. But you have an 18-week program. How does that work? I mean, I understand it centers on specific social, emotional learning objectives, which build on the previous objective, moving students, I guess, from self-doubt to the point that they are empowered. Would you address that?
Yeah, you've given the framework. So
the
beginning of the 18 weeks, obviously, we got to make the match. So we train the mentors and the mentees on what they're going to be, you know, engaging in for the next, you know, year, basically,
mm-hmm.
school year. And we start off in really safe ways. So before we ask them, you know, hey, like, tell me about your learning difference, we actually start by something more simple. And again, using art, we say, you know, why don't you tell me about a strength of yours? So maybe we'll say, let's make superhero capes, something fun, right? What would be your superpower? A lot of times our curriculum kind of kicks off around Halloween anyhow, so we'll just play into that. Because it takes like September, we train the guys, and then you know, come October, we're ready to match everybody up. And then by the next week, we say, okay, well, let's, every superhero has their weakness. What's your kryptonite? So now we're starting to get a little more concrete. And so over the weeks, very carefully and slowly and safely, and only ways that the mentees feel comfortable with, we actually start to bring out, what does it mean to have a learning difference? What does it mean to use an accommodation? What's your utility belt? That's your accommodations, right? And as they build these art projects, they actually are building language to ask for what they need. And by the end of those 18 weeks, they've gone on this whole learning journey with their mentee, not only where we hopefully, you know, establish a relationship between the mentee and mentor, but they also see in community all these other mentees and mentors having gone through the same thing. They are a part of this beautiful alliance. And then for the rest of their lives, they have that in their back pocket. We've actually learned, if you're in our program for 1 year, it is sticky enough. Mm-hmm. It is transformative enough that it will allow kids to spend the rest of their time in school drawing on those experiences. And many times the mentees we find come back to be mentors, which is really fun. Very easy to train them.
Ah, yes. That, I would think so. You have what? Oh, you're in 150 or so different locations?
Different places.
Tell us about that. I mean, because the reason I say that is because my next question is going to be, what if somebody is listening to this program and they hear what you're doing and they think, wow, that would be great to establish a program like that here? So That's why I'm asking you all that.
So, yeah, we're in 150 places in about half the country. And every one of those schools started because somebody in your community listening said, hey, I think this is a good enough idea that I'll champion it here. Not one of those school sites came about unless somebody picked up the phone and said, hey, I'm a parent in this school. I think that it would really benefit my community. Or, hey, I'm a teacher or a school leader. And depending on who calls us, we'll explain who else in the community might need to sign up. Because you need a couple of people, right? You need the families involved. Obviously, you need the kids involved. You need the teachers involved. And we work, you know, we're partners with every school. And honestly, I would say while our curriculum is the same across the country, our mission is the same across the country, we respect that every community is different. And we actually love that every community is different. And we step in thinking, okay, what are the assets that you have here? And how can we just help create some connective tissue to make those things all work a little bit better together?
Well, I'm thinking because we have two major universities here. We have Florida State. This is Florida State. We have FAMU, Florida A&M. We have great community college. It's not community college. It's a university now, Tallahassee Community, I guess, University. I don't know if I got that correct, but I know they recently changed their name. And, you know, so it seems like we have some of the foundation that would be necessary to take this to the next level. We've got College of Education here. I mean, so that's why I ask.
Oh, Liz, let's do it today. That's great.
No, I'm serious. I mean, as I talk to you, I'm like, we've got everything that we need here. You know, we've got the students. We got the College of Education. We've got major universities here. We could do something like that.
All right, we're on record, you and me. Let's go do it.
Okay. Now, hey, I might really give you a call because
that'd be great.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Yeah.
Anybody who's listening who wants to help Liz and I,
that would be great.
Reach out because we need all the help we can get, but it just takes will. Mm-hmm. It just takes will, you know?
How has COVID-19 impacted, you know, the learning, those who learn differently, especially when you're talking about this using a lot of remote type equipment.
Yeah, we've been very optimistic in this conversation, so I'll just have to be a little realistic, which is to name. Before the pandemic, there was a pandemic for kids who learn differently. We already know that kids who learn differently were dropping out twice as much as their non-LD ADHD peers. We already know that they overrepresented in our prison population on their unemployment line. So you think about what was happening across the country for kids who learn differently before the pandemic, and it wasn't ideal. So when the pandemic hit, just like anybody on the margins, kids who were LD initially, I think, suffered more than most. Mm-hmm. And they unfortunately suffered in silence because of the way in which I mean, look, we were all reacting. I don't know for you, for me. I mean, I'm still in shock. We're not done. We're not done. Mm-mm. We've gone from hiding behind computer screens to hiding behind masks. But you know, this is a journey. But I think kids with LD were all the more marginalized. And at the beginning, it was very sad to see that some of the very legal rights that protect kids in schools to this day were originally suggested to be revoked because the adults felt somehow we wouldn't be able to provide their accommodations, which was unacceptable. That said, I will say the innovation that happened in schools and the ways in which we ultimately met the needs of many of the students in our communities. And I saw this with our partners across the country. Eye to Eyes program had to change just like everybody else to become virtual and to be more flexible. And those things I think are gonna stick. So while I think kids who learn differently are absolutely coming back traumatized. And if you had a learning difference and say you were also a low-income kid or a kid of color, you know, it's twice or three times as bad. Mm-hmm. So it is not surprising to me that social emotional learning is being discussed in general and also explicitly around kids with LD because of, in some ways, the very traumatic experiences they've just come from. I also think there's opportunity because if we could pivot the way we did in a pandemic, then we can absolutely pivot now. We do not have to go back to normal where things weren't working. We can do better.
Okay. In this last couple of minutes, one, what can parents do? What kind of suggestions can you make to parents?
Well, I hope this isn't self-serving, but since we only have a minute, I hope folks may go to davidflink.com because I have a lot of resources there for parents. But I think in the short version, listen to your kids, believe in them, help them advocate for how they like to learn best, and let them know their brains are beautiful.
Okay. What happens when students graduate from high school who learn differently? Where do they go? What do they
do? My dream is they go to the next place that lets them realize their dreams. Maybe that's community college or a four-year institution. Maybe it's vocational school or straight to the workforce. But more than anything else, what I hope happens is that the things they've learned, not so much academically, but how they learn best and how they ask for what they need, sticks with them. So when they go on to college, they fight for and continue to get what they need to succeed in school because it's not always going to be the same thing. It's a different context and not all their rights carry over.
And you were very successful at it. I mean, so I wanted to add that to it too.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I was lucky that I chose a college that had no core curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of funny because while there was a disability service office, which technically was meant to ensure that the accommodations I got previously would carry over, I just went to most of my teachers and just said, hey, this is after I figured out not to have your dyslexic roommate proofread your papers. And I started talking about my dyslexia more. I would go up to the teachers and say, hey, I'm dyslexic. So, you know,
how'd they respond to you? Very briefly, how did they respond to you?
Were, you know, most of them were enthusiastic because my context was, I am excited to learn from you. I want to give you my absolute best effort. And here's how I know how to do it. And I would say 90% of teachers are thrilled to hear that from a student.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
there was one or two teachers who really just were like, well, you're, I don't really, and I just knew, and I had the luxury in college and there was no core to say, I'm not going to take that class. That's not an option that every kid has. And that's not an option that every institution provides, but it is an option when you go into the work world. I'll tell you my first job before committing my life to Eye, I briefly worked as an admissions officer where, as folks may know, you read all day. That's your job. You read kids' applications all day. Talk about not believing in the very thing I've been talking about. I'm dyslexic. Why would I choose to read all day for a living? I loved the job, but I was really, really bad at it, or at least really, really slow at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, pick a job that, you know, reflects the things you like to do, not just the things you hope to like to do.
Well, you know, it's time out. And David, thanks so much. I appreciate your time. I have been talking with David Flink, founder of Eye to Eye. He has also been selected for CNN Heroes Top 10. He has a chance to be named the Hero of the Year at the 15th annual CNN Heroes All-Star Tribute. It will be hosted by Anderson Cooper and Kelly Ripa on Sunday, December 12th. So you can go online and vote for him. To my listening audience, thank you so much for your time and your ear. And again, David, I appreciate your time. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.